You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, G7 leaders meet in Italy to agree on a unified approach to the Syrian conflict. But will they succeed? My guests, Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, will discuss this and the day's other top stories, including it's been 100 days of Antonio Guterres. But how has the UN Secretary General performed so far? Plus, Beijing wants to pay its citizens for giving the government tip-offs about foreign spies. And we ask why Turkish diplomats are questioning an Austrian children's newspaper. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Ivor Gaber. Oscar Guardiola Rivera is a reader in law at Birkbeck, University of London, and Ivor Gaber is a professor of journalism at the University of Sussex. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we start the show with Syria. The fallout from last week's airstrikes by the United States continues, and today foreign ministers of the G7 nations are meeting in Italy to try and achieve a unified approach to the conflict. Ivor, they probably will put out some kind of statement that says that they're unified, but do you think behind closed doors or back home in their capitals, some of these leaders are probably a bit concerned by what happens next?
I think a bit concerned is an understatement. I have to say very reluctantly and regrettably, I think the Geneva process is going nowhere. This is going to be resolved by force on the ground, I'm afraid. I think it's very difficult to know what comes next, because we're dealing essentially with three, dare I say, irrational characters. We've got Mr. Trump, President Trump, President Putin, and Mr. Assad. And those are the three key players. And to make predictions about what they will do from here would be very rash. So I have to say, in a very long-winded way, I don't know where we go from here. It's dependent what happens on the ground, depends what happens to those three leaders.
As we go through this part of the debate, we understand your standpoint. Are you one of those people who reluctantly thinks it was a good idea to bomb, or do you think it wasn't a good idea to bomb?
I'll let you know in about 5 years' time. I mean, it's very difficult to say. For example...
But if you were Mr. Trump and you had that power, would you have said, yes, actually, in the circumstances?
No, I wouldn't, because that decision was totally emotional. He saw the pictures of CNN on the babies. It was a totally emotional reaction, which cannot be a worse basis to make these serious decisions. Now, I don't support those who say he should have gone to the UN, unfortunately, is just nonsense, because unfortunately the UN, we have the veto, the Russian, if not the Chinese veto, that would have been a waste of time. But I don't think that was a sound basis to make the decision. Whether it was the right or wrong decision is a different issue. Perhaps the right decision would have been 2 years ago when Assad first used chemical weapons and he crossed Mr. Obama's red line. However, we are where we are. What would I have done? I suppose I would have got on the hotline to Mr. Putin and said, this is not on. And I would have urged as strongly as I could Mr. Putin to make some sort of public statement disassociating Russia from it, warning Assad that this is not acceptable.
Well, first of all, you have to get them to agree that it happened. The trouble is the Russians still claim that it was, you know, it was probably chemicals stored by the rebels.
But I think they claim that after Trump's action, as I recall. I think that was their defensive position, because Trump had forced them to do it. Now, look, I'm not definitively saying Trump was wrong. I think it's a terribly difficult decision. All I'm saying is I think to make those decisions on the basis of some pictures of distraught children... is no basis. And that's what worries me about President Trump, that he might have jumped the right way this time, but we're dealing with a man who's incredibly emotional, impulsive, narcissistic. And to make international geopolitical strategic decisions of huge importance on that basis worries me greatly.
Oscar, it's amazing what, you know, a couple of months can do. You know, we felt that we were going to get with Mr. Trump, a leader of the United States who would see quite quickly a rapprochement with Putin, and that we would see a kind of a new understanding. It was clear that from the campaign trail that Donald Trump did not want to do anything that would involve the US with Syria. Here we are, you know, just a couple of months later, relations between the US and Russia are worse than they were under Obama, and he has bombed Syria. Where does it go from here, do you think?
Well, we're still receiving mixed messages from the US administration. I mean, we're Rex Tillerson just said today that they hope that there will be an opportunity for the Syrian people to rid themselves of Assad by a political settlement. This may be hinting at some, idea that there could be a coordinated effort with Russia, which will not include Assad. But this seems to contradict the events of last week. So I think we are in deep trouble here because, one has to be very reluctant to replace international law and international reasonable international geopolitics with the whims of three very narcissistic men. It's very complicated to make predictions on the basis of that, but one can at the very least predict that the outcome will not be good, certainly not for the Syrian people.
And what do you make of Donald Trump's supporters? Because, again, it seems that many on the far right of the Republican movement, or not even on the far right, on the right of the Republican movement, are saying, look, this was a disastrous decision. He no longer has my support. You know, the whole reason we got this man into power, because we don't want to be involved in any foreign wars. It's only America first from now on. Is Donald Trump being dragged by events into that kind of, do events in a way almost demand of you that you end up in a rather center ground? He may not want to be doing the things that Obama did, or, but kind of events drag you there in a way.
It's very difficult to put oneself in the mind of such a person, but perhaps his reaction was not just emotional in the sense that Ivor explained so well. Also, this is a man who was very keen on trying to repair his own image. And his image had been dented in the United States. If anything, his ratings have gone up. Now he is in good terms with McCain, even with the Clintonians. Of course, there is a reaction from the Breitbarters. But does he need them now that he is the president? Does he need them as much as he needed them during the campaign? I think not. And I think that explains why he would be ready to lose that kind of support. At the same time, the mixed messages that we're receiving from the U.S. administration do seem to entail that he's still trying to have it both ways. And again, the problem here is that we do not have a coherent policy. These are emotional reactions or reactions on the basis of, repairing one's self-image out of narcissism and so on. That is certainly not a sound basis for international politics.
Ivor, it's interesting what Oscar says, because it's correct. Suddenly he's done something. He's achieved something, whether you like what he's achieved or not. And after months of being stuck in the quagmire of trying to get through a so-called Muslim ban, or to change any of the rules and regulations he's wanted altered that prove much more difficult, here he's been able to do something decisive and that's worked. But the trap surely is that he can't do it again very easily, because now the Russians are saying, we and the Iranians will take action against you if you attack. Whether they will or won't, we don't know. So now he's in a stymied position, because either he doesn't take any action again and it looks like he's backed off, as the Russians have said, or he does do it again. And, as some of the newspapers today are saying, are we heading for World War III?
Nice thought. I think the Russian and Iranian threats are just that, threats. I don't think there's much they can do or would do. They might increase air defences. They've talked about it for the Syrian government's forces, but that would be defensive. I cannot for the life of me believe they would launch an attack on American forces. However, where we go from here, having thought about it since listening to Oscar, it is very difficult to see, because we've got essentially we've got egos on the line, and they're shouting at each other and not wanting to back down. Is there a diplomatic way out? Well, it's perhaps something we'll discuss later, but maybe even if the UN isn't going to be decisive, it might provide a space where they can shout at each other in more, how shall we say, formalised, restricted settings. I think the other calculation that could be made, which is bizarre if you're talking about Mr. Trump, the Americans could increase sanctions on the Russians. Their sanctions, there are still sanctions on the individual members of the Russian government and the Russian hierarchy that could be increased. And there's talk of that. But it is ironic, given that for the last 6 months we've been talking about the Trump-Putin axis as the new geopolitical centre of gravity. How much truth there was then, and how much truth is it now, is historians are going to have, so if they're still around, are going to have so much to pore over the last 6 months of or 12 months of international politics.
If there is World War III, we won't be around.
Oscar, just as a sidestep, we often don't look at the filter that other parts of the world put over these events. We focus on what the US and Europe thinks. Obviously with your speciality even of Latin America, there has been some response there over the weekend. Could you just tell us, when you've looked at the papers, how they have filtered this and how the governments are trying to do their bit as well?
Quite interesting, actually, because you got the usual responses from the usual suspects. So, for instance, the president of Colombia very quickly went on air saying that Colombia supported the Trump administration, which I'm sure the Trump administration doesn't care about at any rate. But the interesting reaction came from the Bolivian ambassador, Sacha Llorente. Bolivia has a seat at the UN Security Council. And Bolivia pointed out that two things. Llorente held a photograph of Colin Powell's infamous Iraq speech and reminded the members of the Security Council of the fact that it was unwise to jump into conclusions given this very recent history, and more reasonable course of action was for no power to to give to itself the roles of judge, investigator, and executioner. And that call for, due process and rule of law in international relations still holds, even if, as Ivor puts it, there, of course, will be a veto if another resolution comes. But if there is a call for an investigation, it would be very difficult for Russia to deny that sort of call within the UNSC. And then we would have the right basis for a more coherent strategy.
Well, this is a good moment to bring in the UN, where Antonio Guterres has now been running the organization for 100 days. Ivan, on the Syrian conflict, what can he do? What should he do? Is he doing it enough?
I think being Secretary General of the UN is a job I'd love to have, but it's a thankless task. You have responsibility with no power. As we were talking about, the way the UN was set up, the Security Council veto makes it very, very difficult for Secretary Generals to do a great deal other than through sheer force of personality. Kofi Annan was the last Secretary General to achieve things through sheer force of personality. So it's far too early to cast a judgment on Guterres yet. But there are things that he can do. He has to be very careful about not offending the great powers, as they say, the five Security Council members. But nonetheless, there are things, for example, just harking back very briefly to the issue of Syria, you can have a General Assembly resolution which isn't binding, as opposed to Security Council one, which is a demonstration of world condemnation. And I don't think the Russians would want to see that, but they couldn't veto it. However, whether the Secretary General would want to push it that far in his first first 100 days, I doubt. I think, obviously, the jury's out. But, for example, you mentioned the 100 days, which obviously is a comparison with the US president's first 100 days. The power that the US president has compared to the UN Secretary General is 100 to 1. The UN Secretary General has the power to persuade, and that's about it.
Oscar, 100 days, he's done some interesting things. He got very involved in what's happening in Cyprus and has tried to kind of knock heads together there, and perhaps being Portuguese, having some understanding of all the players there, it feels a problem closer to home, perhaps more solvable. He seems to want to be out there doing things. Do you rate him so far?
What I know of him having actually met him in the past and seen what he did as the head of the UN Office for Refugees, I can say that he's more general than secretary. And I think that will come very nicely to him, particularly now that he's dealing with so many and so different challenges. You must recognize that he has begun with terrible luck. In these 100 days, all manner of crises have exploded on his desk. And of course, there is the additional point of the fact that the United States is one of the main providers of funds to the United Nations, and the Trump administration has said that they want to cut it back. That 29% is very important. So things he will do, he will try to rally the General Assembly, not necessarily in that direction, but he will try and give a second opportunity to his UN special envoys, who have been doing a fantastic job, actually, in Syria. Let us remember that we were very close to seeing an actual political settlement. This week, next week, the process was heading somewhere. Now, that might not be the case. But this can change very quickly, because, as Ivor pointed out, the strategy, the Trump strategy is really incoherent. The idea that we can just go and start World War III is, of course, nonsense. So in the end, whether we like it or not, diplomacy has to win the day.
Ivor, it's interesting that he met Vladimir Putin in the run-up to taking up the role. He still has not met Donald Trump, and we know what Donald Trump's feelings are about the UN, and he wants to cut what the US pays. So the idea that it's a talking shop where you could potentially bring, for example, here, Russia and the US together, he's kind of lost some authority if the Americans don't go along with the game.
Well, Donald Trump was yesterday against the UN. Who knows where he is today? And in particular, I was thinking of the very effective interventions the US representative of the Security Council made last week, when she directly attacked the Russians in very forceful ways. And that coverage would have been grist to Mr. Trump's mill when it went out on all the American networks. There she was eyeballing the Russian deputy ambassador, as it happened, very effectively. And I think you say it's a talking shop. I think we underestimate the importance of a talking shop. To quote Winston Churchill, jaw is better than war. But also, international public opinion is formed, I wouldn't say exclusively at the UN, but it's a very important forum. And to have your man, or in this case, your woman, in the spotlight, in the Security Council, directly attacking the Russians over the Syrian bombing, I think is quite effective PR. So yesterday, Mr. Trump was against the UN. I think today he feels quite warmly towards it.
Oscar, just a small thing. It's interesting when you see people speak at the UN. It's the way that the architecture, the design conspires. When she made that speech, you look important when you're there and you're speaking to, you really do feel that you're talking to the world. Do you think that when it goes well for somebody making a good political comment, that is an amazing backdrop in which to do it, in a way?
It is crucially important. Again, wars are never won by military means alone. And in fact, for the most part of modern history, it is, in the end, the role of diplomats to bring these conflicts to an end. And that's precisely what you see and what we saw last week at the UN Security Council. This is the place where the right arguments and the right words command the force of public opinion. And that force is second to none.
I was just going to add on your characterization of how important. I sit on a UNESCO body in Paris, and I have in front of me a sign saying the United Nations, United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and I speak on behalf of Her Majesty's government. I feel terribly important. And occasionally we do a tiny bit of good. It's on report journalistic safety. But it does give you a sense of importance, and B, you realize how these things are done, and they are done, as Oscar says, eventually through negotiation. A lot of the negotiation takes place at UNESCO, where I sit, but also at the UN, not on the table, not in the main venue, but in the bars, in the coffee bars, in the restaurants, where you start to hammer deals out with friends of enemies, so to speak. And that's the way it works, but that's the way it has to work.
Yes, there's something just great about watching someone speak, and you know it's being translated into numerous languages, and watching the faces, how it's going down. There's that delay of a second.
Telling a joke is very dangerous because you have to wait for the reaction, and it doesn't always work.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, and Ivor Gaber. We're going to be back right after this.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Isabel Allende.
I think that through writing, I exorcise my obsessions, my demons, my grief.
The Chilean author sits down with me, Ed Stocker, to discuss writing as therapy, the art of storytelling, US politics, and her commitment to human rights, alongside her deep-rooted connections to Latin America.
I live in English, really, but I think in Spanish. I would feel ridiculous making love in English.
The Big Interview with Isabel Allende. Download it now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, and still with me, of course, are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Ivor Gaber. We take a look now at China. As of today, Beijing's 22 million residents are being offered cash rewards of up to 500,000 yuan. That's about £58,000, or I think it's about 65,000 euros, for providing authorities with tip-offs of foreign spies. This is part of a new anti-espionage campaign, and they want citizens to help protect China from traitors and spies. It all sounds very melodramatic. Oscar, do you think it's based on a real fear or real, I'm sure everyone is potentially spying on China, but is it this more for the arena of citizens there, to make people feel that they're under attack, to feel some kind of fear of foreigners? Or do you think there is a genuine moment that they're being spied on more than anyone else?
You know, in this era of cyber surveillance, a story like this feels really good because it feels so old-fashioned. The fact that they go back and rely on knowledge from the masses, it might remind our listeners of something Mao Zedong himself used to say. If you really want to win a war and get intelligence, go to the masses. Whether that will work again, this era of cyber surveillance and so on, who knows? But it does provide something that we tend to forget about when we talk about international politics. A lot of what happens in international politics has more to do with domestic politics. And in this particular case, as it is the case in the other story, the story about Trump and U.S. Intervention in Syria. If you have the people working together, working with you, if you manage to unite, that kind of support is very important. It is the reason why, of course, Putin is still in Syria, because he has worked for him domestically. So maybe that's the idea. But I have to say that the part of the story that I really loved was the one, you know, warning Chinese women not to allow themselves to be seduced by spies. It's just wonderfully old-fashioned.
I thought you were going to say that famous Mao Zedong quote, political power grows out of the barrel of a Facebook feed, which I'm not sure is legitimate. But I just wanted to add, when I read that story, I was reminded of the time I spent some time working with in China, training journalists and press officers. The two are much the same. They used to have joint classes, but that's another issue. What I was struck by was how strongly they felt, not about communist ideology, about Chinese nationalism, and how they felt they were surrounded by enemies, whether it was Japan or whether it was India or whether it was Russia. They gave me this very strong impression that the nation of China actually was most important. And I think this story is indicative that clearly Li feels the need to reinforce that sense of Chineseism, that the rest of the world's against us and we've got to do it by our own, pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps or whatever.
But it comes with a certain irony, doesn't it? Because everyone feels that probably the Chinese are rather good at spying as well. So it's a double-edged game. But I think, you know, the point that Oscar makes, Ivor, is also interesting, that in reality it's going to be a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old with a laptop who's probably, you know, working for some government somewhere that's the real spy, rather than someone walking around with a raincoat and a trilby.
I teach a lot of...
spies.
Possibly. I would say I teach a lot of Chinese students, and they are incredibly social media literate. In China, they have their own social media, but it doesn't take them long to work out to access it. And there are generations of Chinese young people, just like young people around the world, who, as you say, are far more able to hack into government databases than old-fashioned spies in trilby hats picking up rocks and looking for messages.
Where do you think this line about dashing Westerners seducing Chinese women to steal their secrets comes from?
There's probably an old a movie that you and I aren't aware of. This was the plot, and the young Li saw it and thought, yep, this is what happens. This
Somebody has been watching too many James Bond.
I'll have to say, I don't know what the Chinese equivalent of the silly season is, but this story just feels a touch like a desperate Chinese reporter looking for a line.
Well, we're going to have the Turkish version of the silly season now, because finally on today's programme, we're going to head to Austria, where Turkish diplomats have been questioning, or asking questions about, rather, a children's newspaper there. In question is an article on Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his handling of dissidents. The story said that he does not tolerate people who have a different opinion than he does, and in recent months he's put many opponents in jail. Oscar, it's funny that they are so concerned about, you know, their image at the moment, and here they are apparently contacting the newspaper, protesting, all sorts of people phoning up to say, you know, why have you run this story? It's kind of anti-Turkey. But I guess it puts a spotlight on the fact that we have this referendum coming up to give the president more rights potentially, and there are many, many expat Turks living in Austria, and it just feels like everyone's getting very fired up and incredibly sensitive about anything that's written now about Turkey.
But you see again, Andrew, I mean, the wonderful thing is that the thread connecting all of the stories that we have talked about today is precisely this overblown concern with self-image is there in Trump, is there in Putin, is there in the Chinese story. It's also here. Erdogan's people seem totally obsessed about protecting Erdogan's image, even from a children's newspaper. So perhaps if in the Chinese case somebody has been watching too many James Bond movies, perhaps in the Turkish case somebody has been rereading the famous fable of the child and the emperor. Look, he's naked.
The magic suit of clothes.
Ivor, it does feel that it's easy to whip up a kind of, you know, a lot of people to say, this person's doing wrong. Social media, we know it can get used. Do you feel this is just, again, as I was saying, a case of oversensitivity in the run-up to the referendum?
Well, I think it's actually a serious story in the sense that A, Erdogan does not deal kindly with journalists who write things that he doesn't like. So I wouldn't want to portray him as a joke figure. I think he's a threat to press freedom. He's a threat to freedom full stop. But secondly, I think it does indicate that, as we've been saying, the sensitivity. And again, Turkey is very similar to China. It's a nation that feels it's surrounded by enemies. And Turkish nationalism is a very powerful force. And that's what Erdogan is playing at, and particularly playing on the fears or the hopes of the Turks living in Europe, of which there are many, and he wants their votes.
Well, we ended with children's news, and I think we start some of the grown-up news. But the Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Ivor Gaber, thank you so much for joining us here today on Midori House. That's all we have time for today. The show was produced by Carlos Rabello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Helena Geria. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.